This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 23rd, 2021. I'm Sarah Crespi. Each week, we feature the most interesting news and research published in Science and the sister journals. First up, contributing correspondent Warren Cornwall. He's going to talk about a 50-year, $50 billion project to rebuild Louisiana's vanishing coast. Next up, researcher Dion Vlakis discusses his Science Advances paper on a new process for recycling many kinds of plastics into fuels and lubricants. Now we have contributing correspondent Warren Cornwall. He wrote this week about a 50-year, $50 billion engineering project to rebuild a huge sweep of the coast of Louisiana. Hi, Warren.
Hi, Sarah.
This is a big project, and it's going to take time and money to do this, but the goal is big, too. Talk about what the stakes are, what's been lost, what's being lost still, and, you know, hopefully going to be regained through this engineering project.
Well, Louisiana has been losing an enormous amount of its coastal wetlands for decades, really. And at stake is the fate of the coast of Louisiana, which is both significant ecologically. It's this rich system of ecosystems filled with fish and birds and marshlands. But it's also a place where millions of people live in places like New Orleans.
Right. Coastal Louisiana. You're going to think about Hurricane Katrina, the damage that it did to the land there, you know, how many people died. Could something like this, all this flooding, be prevented by rebuilding this part of the coastline?
I don't know all of the ins and outs of what led to the level of damage that you had with Katrina, but I believe there's widespread agreement that the loss of coastal wetlands contributed to the scale of that storm and other storms, because these coastal wetlands really act as this buffer that absorbs some of the force of these storms that come raging in off the Gulf of Mexico.
I think it also points up the money side of this as well. The economic damage that Hurricane Katrina cost, $160 billion in damage, is a lot more than this project that we're talking about that's going to be developed for the whole coast of Louisiana over the course of 50 years.
Yeah, and that's one of the major arguments of the proponents of the project is you think doing this is expensive, not doing it is even more expensive.
Oh, how did this loss of this marshland, this coastal loss happen?
The primary factor is that Louisiana is not building land fast enough to keep up with land sinking into the ocean.
Well, how does Louisiana build land?
Well, Louisiana builds land because it's where the Mississippi River flows into the Gulf of Mexico. The river is really this giant conveyor belt that is carrying sand and mud from places as far-reaching as the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachian Mountains. And it's carrying a lot of that sediment down into Louisiana. And it, over geologic time, has built a lot of southern Louisiana. I was talking to a scientist who is telling me that in places, the sediment going back since the Mississippi really began to operate, you can find sediment that is 10 miles deep.
What are the causes for the lack of sediment from the Mississippi?
Well, there's a variety of things. I mean, one is you put dams and other water capture structures further upstream, and they don't just capture water, they capture sediment. But another big problem is that historically, the river was free to move across the landscape. It would flood seasonally and move a lot of sediment out of the river channel and into the surrounding land. And then sometimes it would change its course entirely and flip to another part of Louisiana. It would shift where the sediment was being placed. That's not happening anymore. We've effectively turned the Mississippi River into a giant canal. We've built walls along the sides of the river in order to make it more manageable and predictable and easier to navigate. A lot of that sediment that used to spread out on the land and build southern Louisiana is now being piped straight down the Mississippi and out into the Gulf of Mexico, where it's so deep that, you know, it just sinks to the bottom.
So this is where the engineering experiments come in, especially the project that you're going to talk about in this story. And that's make a big hole and let some Mississippi out and some of the sediment out. Can you talk about the specifics here?
Yeah, so there's a large area called Barataria Bay that is just to the west of the Mississippi River, south of New Orleans, as the river makes its way to the Gulf. This is an area that's filled with marshlands and bayous and is really ecologically a rich area. And it's also losing marshlands at a phenomenal rate because of the processes that I was talking about. The idea is that they're going to try to resurrect some element of that land building power that the river has had over the millennia by chopping a hole in one of these walls that's holding back the river, installing a canal, and then letting a part of the river and the sediment that's in it flow back into this bay. Their hope is that it's going to resume this sediment conveyor belt or pipeline and start piping sediment into this bay and start rebuilding land.
Is that easy to predict where the land is going to be, how much land there is going to be? Does it depend on what the size of the hole and the canal that's built for this offshoot of the Mississippi?
I wouldn't say it's easy to predict, but some elements of it are predictable. They have these computer models that take into account different factors and can give them a sense of how much sediment is going to come through, where it's going to spread, how much of it there's going to be. Other parts, not so much. There are elements like global sea level rise that are sort of beyond the control of the engineers managing this. And then even at a local level, there are variables that aren't well understood. For example, one question is, you have this underlying submerged land in the bay now. And one question is, when you pour all this new sediment on top of it, what's going to happen? The weight of that new sediment is going to press down on the underwater land that's already there. How much is it going to squish it down?
Mm-hmm. Is it going to squish enough that it never really becomes higher at the end of the day?
Right.
And then you're mixing salty and fresh, right?
That's the nature of estuaries, right? I mean, it's this place where the fresh water meets the salt water, and it can make for these very dynamic ecosystems that are very layered. You have different organisms that thrive in different levels of salt versus fresh. On the one hand, it's very rich and diverse, but if you suddenly flick a switch and change those levels, it can also cause a lot of changes in the ecosystem.
This is one part of a much larger master plan. How does it fit in with the overarching plan?
These diversions, and the one in Barataria would be the biggest and one of the first, but it's not the only one. The single impact of these is quite large. I've seen it characterized as the largest ecological restoration project. So, like, how do you measure largest ever? I'm not going to say it is, because maybe there is another one, right? But it's big.
It's what, 50 square kilometers of restoration?
Well, and again, that depends on how much the sea rises and how much the land underneath sinks. But yeah, that's an estimate that has been put out there.
What fraction of the total project cost is this particular diversion?
The cost of this diversion is in the range of $2 billion. And the $50 billion is a whole lot of work that doesn't involve building land. A bunch of it is building new levees and walls to hold back water. A bunch of it is retrofitting buildings and raising them up so that they won't get flooded. And so I guess that's why I would say, in terms of ecological restoration, this diversion project is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in this coastal master plan. But in terms of the overall plan, it's just a small piece.
We keep saying it's a 50-year project. What year are we in now? What stage is this in now? And what are the prospects for it going all the way to 50 years?
Well, 50 years is kind of this rolling number. They had a 50-year plan in 2012, and then they updated it in 2017. So you can think of it as a 50-year plan that goes on forever.
Okay.
But in terms of this large project in Barataria Bay, they could break ground on it as soon as 2023, assuming that they get all the permits that they need. They just crossed this important milestone where the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issued this draft environmental impact statement in March. And that massive tome is going to drive decisions by agencies like the Corps about whether or not to give permits to the state to do this Barataria project. So it's not a done deal yet, but supporters of the project seemed pleased by the results of the study. So they seem to have at least some optimism that they're going to be able to get the permits that they need. The flip side is that there is opposition. There are communities along Barataria Bay that rely on the shrimp and oysters that grow in the bay and other ways of life that they have become accustomed to with the current system that are going to be disrupted.
Has something like this been done elsewhere, trying to rebuild coastal lands by letting sediment build up from river?
It's been done on small scale in Louisiana, but not nearly on this scale. On deltas around the world, there are issues with sediment and erosion and loss of land as a consequence of people basically monkeying with natural processes. I was just talking this morning with a researcher who's based in Louisiana who has studied the Mississippi Delta, but has also studied the Ganges-Brahmaputra Delta. And we were discussing how there they have a problem where they built all these walls around flood-prone land 50, 60 years ago. And as a consequence, it short-circuited the way that that system moves sediment to build land. And now they are experimenting with breaking down some of those walls to let the sediment back into the land that's sinking.
The maps, they really tell a story that this is the land lost. This is what might be regained. But even if this master plan is executed perfectly, the land comes back, marshes come back, it's not actually going to outstrip the loss of this land, both from the lack of sediment and also from oceans rising with climate change. Is that something we just have to live with? We're just going to assume that Louisiana is going to lose its coast. This is just going to delay that.
That's what the scientists tell me. I don't know if they're certain that Louisiana is going to lose all of its coastal wetlands, but I think there's, without a doubt, a significant amount of its coastal wetlands in the next 50 years, whether they do this kind of restoration work or not. The goal of the people who want to do that restoration work is to lose less of the wetlands. And even then, there's research suggesting that in the long run, all of these wetlands effectively are going to be lost as sea level rises. But one of the researchers who was involved in that work told me that even if you can buy some decades extra, that is worth it in terms of allowing people to figure out how to respond in a more measured and planned way.
Planned retreat?
Yeah, that's certainly a term that land managers and people living on coasts everywhere are talking about, and Louisiana is no different. In fact, in some ways, they're sort of at the forefront of having to confront this because they're just losing land at a phenomenal rate.
All right. Thank you so much, Warren.
It's a pleasure talking.
Warren Cornwall is a contributing correspondent based in Washington State. You can find a link to the story we discussed at sciencemag.org/podcast. Less than 10% of the plastic that's made gets recycled, and most of it ends up in the landfill or ocean. Next, we're going to hear from Dion Vlakis about a new chemical process to recycle plastic waste into fuels and lubricants. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Change your job and you might just change the world. For anyone who's looking to get ahead in or just plain get into science, there's no better, more trusted resource than Science Careers. And it's free. On our site, you can search career opportunities across all disciplines and levels, research potential employers, sign up to get job alerts via email, upload your resume or CV to the searchable database, or read career advice articles. There's no shortage of global problems today that science can't solve. Be part of the solution. Visit sciencecareers.org today. Plastics are a threat to the environment. Yes, some can be recycled, but much more ends up in landfills or the ocean. This week in Science Advances, Dion Vlachos and colleagues write about a different way to recycle plastics. They talk about a process for converting plastics into fuel and lubricants. Hi, Dion.
Hi, Sarah.
So typically now when something's recycled, say a plastic bottle, it's chopped up, melted, and then turned into something that won't be touching food, like a bench. But this really doesn't happen that often. Something like 10% of plastic is recycled. Dion, why is this such a tough problem, getting a second use out of plastic?
The plastics are actually made primarily for different properties. One of these is mechanical strength. So you want to make them really strong so they can hold well. And so this actually strength is what makes them very difficult to break down.
Durable plastics.
The plastics are durable. Plus, they have other properties. You don't want small molecules to go through your packaging, like oxygen, and oxidize your food. So we try to build properties, but the durability is a main trait that we try to have in these materials. So that makes them very hard. And so when you actually break them down, you start already deteriorating their properties. And then you have to use them in materials of less value that don't come into contact again, with food.
Right. You don't want to recycle something that was used and then mixed with a bunch of other plastics and then end up with something wrapping your raw chicken.
Right.
So what your paper does is you look at chemical conversion rather than chopping and melting. How is this a different approach? What are some of the steps that you take that are different from previous processes?
We actually heat up the plastic in the presence of a catalyst. This catalyst is a two-component material. It's a hybrid catalyst. And that turns out to be very important. In essence, one of these components cracks the material. The other one actually is chasing the material into stable material, avoiding formation of other solids. It can also branch the molecules. So take straight molecules and make them into branch. This actually gives good properties for fuels and lubricants.
And what is special about the catalyst that you use for this process?
So as I mentioned, it's a hybrid catalyst, so it has two components. The components actually are known materials. It's just when you put them together, they do kind of the magic.
Yeah.
If you put individually each one of them, it does barely okay. So we have looked into the mechanism of how that works. And each component does a piece, but one has to move from one component to another. Think about a dance where you just move around from one place to another place and forth and back. And so through a few basically dancing steps, you are able actually to process the plastic and get to the right molecules.
One thing that you noted in your paper that is good about this catalyst is that you can reuse it. So that's something that happens a lot in chemistry, where you have a high-value catalyst that it's very expensive to get, or you can only use it once, and that's not something that's going to be an issue here?
It doesn't look to be an issue. We can regenerate the catalyst, we can reuse it, and that's important for economic viability.
That also brings up the fact that you're going to be heating this up. So is it an energy-intensive process?
These molecules are very hard to break down. So you have to use energy and you have to heat them up. We heat them up into low 200 degrees centigrade, which is kind of high, but in comparison to other processes that heat up to 800 degrees, we use half, a third, or a fourth of the energy. This is actually much more energy efficient process in comparison to the more traditional approaches other researchers have used.
I guess kind of going to the basics here, if you just burn plastic, you get energy out of it. But this is turning plastic into fuel and then you burn that fuel for energy. So why do it that way?
Because it's more energy efficient. You are actually able to get high liquid density. So you can put in transportation in cars, in trucks, in airplanes, so you can actually move it around. Whereas when you burn it, it's actually a solid material. This is actually very light, the plastics, so you cannot really carry them in automobiles. Because you say, I will burn the plastic in a car or an airplane.
It's kind of joining the pipeline for fuels. It's the same.
Correct. That's a good way to put it. You know, the energy density, basically, how much energy you have in the material, in the plastic, it's just too light and it's a solid.
Right. You don't want to stuff your car with styrofoam and then burn it.
Correct. So eventually, as you say, we do burn it, but you actually transform it into something that is transportable. We can actually move it from anywhere a plastics recycling facility is to where we actually need it at very low cost, with very low energy, is the transportation, right? We transport things from Middle East all the way to the U.S.
I mean, because we all basically at this point have a landfill within a couple miles of us that's just full of plastics.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see this as a way of getting energy back out of that material, you know, stuff that's mixed, stuff that's commingled, stuff that might even have residue on it from its previous use?
Absolutely. This is exactly not the idea. You want to deploy this technology all over the world and be able to harness the energy that's in there. You mentioned about the mixed non-plastic and being commingled with other things. This is one of the still remaining grand challenges, because you have to, it asks you a question whether a catalyst can actually treat all the plastics. If there are impurities and other things from food to paper, how that is going to impact, you know, the catalyst. So one of the challenges we have to face moving forward is how do we really make this resilient catalyst, resilient systems that can treat all sorts of mixed plastics, waste plastics from everywhere. These materials we have actually made are fairly agnostic. They can actually crack down polyethylene, polypropylene, polystyrene. It looks to work on many what we call virgin materials that we can buy from a chemical company, but also real materials we have in the laboratory. So it's a step forward in the right direction, but there's still a lot to be done in creating systems that can actually treat the real, real waste that comes in. We don't know even what's there.
Right. So far you've tested it on virgin materials. Have you used it on post-consumer materials? You've tried it out on that?
We have tried some, and it works, you know, quite well, actually. It's a question of the mixed ones coming from a trash can.
Right.
Or a landfill, you know, have other impurities in there. So that's a challenge.
It does seem like you can tune your process to the different kinds of plastics that come out of the factories.
That's correct. The beauty of these materials is we can tune. We can tune how big the pores of the materials is, how much of each component we put in. And so we can tune it to different plastics and also to different products. So we can make different things.
Yeah. What kind of things can you make?
You can make, you know, primarily jet diesel fuel and some lubricants. And again, the important aspect there is that these things are branched. So we start primarily with the straight molecules. We are able actually in the process during the chemistry to change them. That is very important. Otherwise, you make, you know, materials which are solid, like a fat.
Oh, yeah. We don't want it to be solid at room temperature. You know, I talked a little bit before about how you don't just burn plastic because it's not energy dense, but we're talking about making fuel from plastic. Is it going to be cheaper if recycled plastic is a feedstock rather than virgin petroleum?
It depends on the prices of oil. That fluctuates, as we know, significantly over time. And it depends on the price of the plastic in the waste. So if you assume that the plastic waste is free, you have to basically remove it from landfills. The feedstock price could be lower than that, you know, of crude oil. And then if you look, you know, how much energy you put in to produce the product, that's a second factor you need to consider. And then you need to think about what product are you making. For example, in the case of lubricants, the price could be even 10 to 100 times more that of fuels. So if you start making more value-added type of products, it actually makes, you know, the whole process economically viable.
So there are outputs that are high value, and especially if, say, someone wanted to pay you to take away all their plastic that's filling up their landfill, you might actually make money for this.
Mm-hmm.
That's very cool. All right. So I know it's kind of like one cog in a huge wheel of how we use petroleum, how we fuel our vehicles, what we do with plastic, but would getting this process out there and scaled up, what would its effect be on greenhouse gases? Are we going to be making more cheaper fuel, or are we going to be cutting down on burning plastic and damaging the environment? Is there any way to know at this point?
There are very few studies on this at this point in terms of the overall CO2 emissions in the circular economy, what the impact will be. But you think about CO2 coming from the atmosphere through photosynthesis in biomass, in grass and wood, that we convert that into fuels, and we convert that into plastics, renewable plastics. And then these plastics, basically, we recycle them in our back. Ideally, you want to put them back into monomers, back to the building block. And that, you know, basically goes circularly indefinitely, right? But 60% of the plastics, the polyolefins, this is very hard. We don't know how to do it at the moment. So we try to put them into more valuable, you know, products. So the CO2 eventually, it goes into the plastics. And if you keep the plastics in an environmentally good manner, you have actually captured the carbon from the atmosphere into a plastic, to a solid. That's not a bad, you know, thing. The problem is that the polluting of the environment, they go into the water and microplastics in humans and fish, etc. So what you like to do is to be able to extend the life of this carbon, be able to use it as much as you can. And eventually, you're going to capture back the carbon dioxide through photosynthesis into wood and switchgrass to use it. So that will actually kind of complete, in my mind, the carbon cycle and make it, you know, much more sustainable.
Yeah, it does sound like we're going to take that petroleum out of the ground no matter what. We're going to turn it into things, and we might as well get as many uses out of it as we can before it ends up in the atmosphere.
Think of this, Sarah, you know, we use less crude, right? If we take the crude, we make a plastic, and then this plastic we convert it back into oil, we have actually used this oil instead of the crude oil coming out of the plastic, so we're using it less. So basically, we produce less CO2. This is kind of obvious that we will produce by doing that less CO2, but you need, you know, to look at the numbers to have a holistic picture of the implications of the technology.
Thank you so much, Dion.
Thank you, Sarah.
Dion Vlachos is a professor of chemical and biomolecular engineering at the University of Delaware and director of the Delaware Energy Institute. You can find a link to his Science Advances paper at sciencemag.org/podcast. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the show on the Science website at sciencemag.org/podcast. On the site, you'll find links to the research and news discussed in the episode. And of course, you can subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. The show was edited and produced by Sarah Crespi, with production help from Podigy, Megan Cantwell, and Joel Goldberg. Transcripts are by Scribby, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.